Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Andy Nathan, and I represent the town of Dillon in this case, registration number 3295. In this case, the trial court essentially took the town's property, its right-of-way, and gave it to the yacht club for use as the yacht club's own parking lot. Now, the trial court couldn't do this on the basis of adverse possession. First of all, couldn't prove adverse possession, and second of all, municipalities cannot be subject to adverse possession. But the result's the same. The trial court gave the property of the town and said that the yacht club may use that property for its own parking anywhere near the yacht club. Now, the town had other things it wanted to do with its right-of-way. But the trial court based its decision on three things. One, equitable estoppel. One, second, unconstitutional retrospective legislation. And three, an unconstitutional abuse of the town of its police powers. And in doing so, the trial court effectively became the decision maker for Dillon, for where parking is allowed, and overruled Dillon ordinances, which are presumed to be constitutional. So let's look at equitable estoppel. Equitable estoppel requires, at its root, reasonable reliance on an affirmative act of the government. And Colorado law repeatedly cautions that equitable estoppel should not be applied to allow a violation of the law and should be cautiously invoked against a municipality. Here, the basis of the plaintiff's claims, and their only basis, is the town's failure 45 years ago to require the developer of the yacht club to have more off-street parking than he ultimately provided for. In doing so, the trial court essentially has allowed the yacht club to park on the town's new rec path, which it built, which is dangerous, and it's unlighted, and it's essentially unusable. Now, the curious thing is that the predecessor in interest to the plaintiffs, the developer, was asked to provide off-street parking by the town. And he pointed to a barely five-year-old Colorado Supreme Court case, and he said, I'm not going to do it. I don't have to do it, and you can't compel me to do it. So this reasonable reliance is completely not existing on the part of the developer. His reliance was on the law saying you don't have to do it.
I thought his reliance was upon the city's position. Yeah, you're right. That's what the Supreme Court said. And so we can't compel you to provide the added parking.
Either way, he's not relying on the fact that the right-of-way around the yacht club becomes the personal parking lot of future residents.
But is there a position that it's the personal parking lot of the yacht club?
Well, that's the way it works out. I mean, their position is that we cannot ticket or tow yacht club residents, guests, or people who are at the yacht club. Now, effectively, we don't know who's who, so it's hard to tell. So we just don't tow anyone. But the point is that that's what the court's ruling was. We can tow people who aren't related to the yacht club from the right of way. We can ticket them, but we can't with the yacht club without violating the court's order. I mean, what the town didn't do that the trial court focused on is it did not say to the developer, sue us. We're going to require this or sue the developer with attorney's fees and liability at stake for a taking, and attack a five-year-old Supreme Court case, which admittedly was overruled some years later. But if that creates an estoppel on the part of the town and it loses its right-of-way, then estoppel really has no meaning because there is no reliance. Now we go to retrospective legislation. So the trial court said two ordinances of the town, the design ordinance for the street in front of the yacht club, and a change in some of the parking requirements were unconstitutionally retrospective. To be unconstitutional, First, they have to be retroactive, which means operate on transactions that have already occurred or rights or obligations that pre-existed. The ordinance here are not retroactive. They do essentially block illegal tandem parking, but they don't penalize the yacht club for its prior violations. They only act forward, and it's not for the court to take on the burdens of deciding which parking regulations are appropriate. That's better left for the legislature and the staffs of municipalities, because municipalities in this state make parking decisions and change parking decisions every day of the year. Now, to be unconstitutional, the ordinance must also be retrospective. That's the Trailer Haven versus Aurora case. And in that case, the Court of Appeals, through Judge Graham, said the purpose of the constitutional ban on retrospective legislation is to prevent the unfairness that results from changing the legal consequences of an act after the act has already occurred. That has no relationship to the facts of this case. The ordinances do not take away or impair a vested right under existing laws. There is no vested right for the yacht club to park in the town's right-of-way. The town never permitted or gave them permission. To the contrary, they said no when they were asked if the yacht club could park, except for limited exceptions during holidays.
Can I ask you, Mr. Nathan, the yacht club almost concedes the vested right piece. I don't want to put words in Mr. Holmes' mouth, but then they talk about, but there's also this requirement about imposing a new disability, and they focus pretty heavily on that. What's your response to that?
Well, again, it's not a new disability, because parking in the right-of-way was always illegal, and tandem parking was always against the code. So we're not imposing a new disability. We're essentially, it's no good deed goes unpunished. We let them park. We didn't always ticket and tow them. And now that the road has changed, it's not changed in location, but it's changed where there are now drainage pans, so you can tell who's parking in the right-of-way and who's not. It's gone from a chip seal, wide-open road to now a paved road with drainage pans. That's not creating a new disability. They've always had that disability. They just tried to get around it. And in the Trailer Haven case, the question was, can you take health, safety, and welfare, things that make them retrospective? And the court said, yeah, you can apply safety codes to buildings that were constructed under a different code because it's a safety measure. Here, we're not even talking about someone else's property. We're talking about the town's property. But there is tons of evidence in the record that says that this is a safety issue.
And that brings you to the police powers argument, and I'm very interested in what you have to say. I mean, the court here went through all the police power arguments, that the menace, all those factors, and made factual findings, and basically rejected all of your arguments about safety and the like. I would really be interested to hear what your response to that, and I guess you have to say there's no evidence in the record.
Well, I can say there's no evidence in the record, and I can also say that in order for you to say something is unconstitutional, you have to overcome a presumption, and you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's the rational relationship test that this court actually discussed last week in a decision involving Bachelor Gulch. So this court knows the law. And the rational relationship test says that you presume things that a town does is constitutional unless you can prove it's unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. What it doesn't allow is for a trial court to go, I'm going to weigh the options that the town had. I'm going to look at the town's reasons. And I'm going to say, I balance those reasons against a burden or inconvenience to the plaintiffs, and I decide what option should have been chosen. This is after a hearing that lasted 5 hours where the council passed an ordinance. So the town presented undisputed evidence at trial about its safety reasons.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Nathan. I know you have limited time. You were talking about the balancing. How do you distinguish the Apple case? The Supreme Court said even if it was a valid exercise of the police power, you can look at the application and then make a balancing, I think.
Well, in Goldblatt, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, the court did discuss that. Of course, it was discussing impediments on someone else's property, not things involving the government's property, but imposing them. And it said, boy, it's really thin here, but the burden's on the plaintiff to prove it. And then it said, and I think this is the quote that I rely on, debatable questions as to reasonableness are not for the court, but for the legislature. And that's essentially what we have here. So we have two police officers with 65 years of experience. We have a town engineer. We have the only expert who testified on this issue, a traffic engineer with a master's from Princeton in traffic engineering. And they testify without contradiction that tandem parking is dangerous and unprecedented. And if you move the road north, that's what you get. That's what the option was that the court thought apparently was the best. That's what the option that the yacht club wanted. But it's undisputed that it would prevent snow storage and we'd have to haul it away at our cost. And it's undisputed that tandem parking, which results, is dangerous because it's like pulling out of a tunnel with no right of way to take a look at things and pulling into a lane of traffic.
But didn't the court go through each, and I acknowledge you raised all those things and there was evidence, and the court went through, and there was evidence on the other side. The court went through each one of those and rejected it. For example, on the tandem parking and the safety, there hasn't been an accident here in 40 years. I mean, doesn't the court have the right to do that and say, I don't buy this safety argument?
Well, first of all, there has been an accident. There was an accident involving a snowplow. Second of all, I'm assuming that you don't have to wait till a child is killed to say, I need a crosswalk there. We got the testimony from Jason Smith, who lived across the street, who testified as to a number of close calls. We have the undisputed testimony of police officers and engineers saying this is potentially dangerous. Doesn't the town have the right to take that information and say, you know, we're going to weigh that, and we think that we need to do something about it? Or do we have to wait until there is a serious accident? Well, I don't think we do. I think that the police powers certainly give this town the right to make these types of decisions. And what they don't do is they don't give a trial court the right to second guess them because there is some evidence. Besides, there's no accident in 45 years. The town doesn't have records. There's no testimony that there's been no accidents in 45 years. If you look at the record, the site in the Appley's brief is from a question asked of a traffic engineer. Assume that there's been no accidents, not testimony to that fact. There is testimony that there hadn't been tandem parking for that long, that it didn't start until mid-2000s. There is testimony that there are always tandem park. But the point is that the town made a decision based upon evidence. This affects drainage, this affects snow storage, this affects cost, and most importantly, it affects safety. And the town is entitled to that presumption. And they must overcome that presumption with evidence. And to be candid, I think the town actually created a stronger presumption with its evidence. So essentially, in making its decision, the trial court said, I'm going to weigh the inconvenience of the yacht club, which I think is substantial, and the other stuff for the town, safety, all the stuff that the town had. And I'm going to elevate the interest of a few because I believe that that's the way I should rule over the interest of the rest of the town.
But didn't the court also look at the issue of arbitrary enforcement? Didn't that also play in? You've had people parking in rights of ways throughout the town and never enforced, just enforced against these folks. Wasn't that a factor? I know you disagree with the merits, but isn't that a factor?
Well, first of all, there's no equal protection claim, so it's legally it's not a factor. But
it goes to arbitrary enforcement of the law. That would be a factor and a reasonableness, wouldn't it?
The point is that there's testimony that the town does allow some people to park in the right-of-way with a temporary allowance, with a contract about liability, with a, and it's revocable. It's essentially a license. The town does allow some things in the right-of-way, although the testimony is that as the town does these construction programs, it's going to change. But again, it's the town's decision based upon safety, and the safety interest in here weighs completely in favor of the town.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Mr. Holm?
May it please the court. My name is Richard Holm. My number is 2965, and I represent the Appalee, the Yacht Club Condominium Homeowners Association, and individuals who reside there. Simply put, the town's appeal is based on its own version of the facts, which it wishes the trial court had adopted, but which it did not. For example, the town repeatedly claims that parking on the right-of-way was always illegal. The trial court in findings numbers 10 through 13 specifically finds it was never illegal. The court finds, the town claims, just as another of many examples, with respect to retrospectivity, they say, quote, the ordinance did not attach a new disability. But the findings of the trial court at pages 8 and 9 state, quote, it is clear that the new town ordinances create new financial disabilities, safety disabilities, and most obviously disability of substantially fewer parking places. The town makes no claim in its briefs that there was any clear error with respect to any finding of fact. It makes no claim in its briefs that there is no evidence to support any of the individual findings of fact made by the trial court. It does not distinguish in its brief, frequently doesn't even mention in its brief, the majority of the cases cited by the trial court and relied on by the trial court. In short, it's my view that the town has left the court with no appellate function to perform.
Counsel, let me ask you this. What about the part about, first of all, are we looking for the police power issue? Are we looking at a rational relationship test?
Yes, I think we are.
Okay. And the second thing is, regardless of whether the court found there had been no accidents, isn't the town entitled to look at the potential for danger involved in this type of parking?
I think the town is entitled to look at the potential, but the Colorado Supreme Court has made it clear, in a case that was not cited by the town, in the Apple case, that the determination as to whether or not a provision or an action by the town violates the police powers, that is a decision left to the judiciary. If what we're going to say is anybody can stand up and say, gee, I think there might be a traffic accident here someday, and that forecloses the judiciary from being able to make a decision when all the other facts go against that position, then I think we have violated the requirements of the Apple case. And indeed, one of the problems that we find with the town in its view of the police power is that it has an unbounded view of the police power, which I think is incorrect. For starters, they don't recognize the word reasonable. Requirements of the police power are that the police power be exercised in a reasonable manner. The United States Supreme Court has said that. The Colorado Supreme Court has said that on numerous occasions. The trial court cited Goldblatt versus Hempstead. It cited People versus Young, People versus Oglethorpe, the Reed ambulance case, all standing for that proposition.
What was unreasonable here about the town's proposal?
What was unreasonable about the town's actions was, number one, that what they were doing was trying to get rid of tandem parking or any parking on the right-of-way, where, first, there had been no showing of any accidents that had occurred within 40 years, except the one that the town created when its snowplow drove into a car. Secondly, that this particular street that we're talking about has one car every 3 to 5 minutes driving on it when it's busy. Furthermore, it was unreasonable because what their action did was to cause economic damage to the yacht club of $1 to $3 million, notwithstanding the fact that had they moved the path 20 feet to the north, it would have caused no damage and would have created every single benefit that the town wants.
Isn't it presumed, though, isn't the unstated factor there that the town has some kind of vested interest in that being able, not the town, I'm sorry, the yacht club, have a vested interest in being able to park that manor?
Well, I think they did have a vested interest.
So it is a property right?
I think it is. The Supreme Court has said that the issuance of a government permit can form the basis for a vested right if the permit holder takes steps in reliance on the permit. In this particular case, we had a situation where the yacht club applied for 3 separate permits. The town had said, we want on-site parking, but when pointed out that that was unconstitutional, said, well, okay, we'll issue the permits anyway. Based on those permits, and the only other place there could be parking was on the right-of-way, based on those permits, the yacht club owners went in and built 3 buildings. That's reliance on a government promise.
Mr. Hall, if I can interrupt you, I guess I'm still not 100% clear what exactly the promise is. I think you're saying it's an implied promise that when they said, okay, you don't have to put on-site parking in, that was an implied promise that the folks can park in the right-of-way. Is that the promise you're talking about?
I think that's the only way that can be read. To say that, well, we're going to approve the buildings, but you can't use them because we're not going to allow any cars there.
But you could still use them. That, I mean, that may be more inconvenient, I recognize, but there's nothing that would prevent someone from using it.
Well, it's not just an issue of inconvenience in this particular case. What the town insists is the solution to this problem is to allow the yacht club people to park at the town parking lot a half mile away up a very steep hill, the path of which is unlit, icy, covered, or you could walk down the street, which is an 18% grade that's so steep that they close it off in the winter so that the cars can't drive down it. And then we wonder why it is the damages to the yacht club are so big, and the question to me is, who in the world would ever buy anything that they were going to be living in if they're told the closest place you can park is a half mile up there? Nobody would. No bank would lend any money on that. So to say, well, you can build this place, but we'll let you park a half a mile away is a fiction.
Is there some authority, Mr. Holm, and just goes, of course, to your equitable estoppel argument, is there some authority that talks about an implied promise being sufficient for equitable estoppel as opposed to an express promise?
I can't give you any case that specifically says that. Okay. I'm not sure that I've seen any case that comes into this kind of an area where somebody says you can do something, but we can then bar anybody from doing it. It's kind of like saying, we'll let you build this unit, and you got water, but now 10 years later, we're going to come in and say, well, you know, we want a swimming pool. And so what we'll do is we'll turn off your water so that we can have a swimming pool. Swimming pool's a public purpose. And therefore, sorry, you can't use it, but hey, there's no promise that you were going to have water for forever. So, you know, I think, in fact, when it's authorized to have these buildings built, and everybody knows that the only place you can go for that is on the right-of-way, then I think, yes, there's an implied promise that has to be enforced, or you're basically telling the government, you can allow this on your right hand, and then 20 years, 40 years later, you can come back and take it away. So it is absolutely our view that equitable estoppel applies in this case. Equitable estoppel prevents the government from making a representation and then, after reliance has taken place on that, coming back and saying, no, we're going to change our mind. So,
what happens if the government doesn't think that's a very voluntary representation? In other words, we don't have any choice. We have to agree with the position taken by the yacht club at the time.
Well, we'd have to imply that that's what the government thought, because there's no evidence in the record that the government said, well, we really have no choice. We've got to bend over and give up to you
There are just simply no records that support that. All we know is they were told that the Denver Buick case existed, and they then issued the permits. And so I guess that's as close as I can get to that one. One of the things that I do think is significant, and that I want to make sure there's no ambiguity about, is that what we're talking about when we talk about parking on the right-of-way is not parking on the main traveled way. What we're talking about is you've got the street in the middle of a 60-foot right-of-way, and we're talking about the property that's on the sides of the street, not parking in the street. And what had happened in this particular case, and again, coming back to one of the things that had been discussed earlier, is that the town, in deciding that it was going to take the design the project the way it was, so that it would have a new street, so it would have drainage, so that it would have a rec path, took the street and moved it right to the very edge of the right-of-way next to Yacht Club. Now, the town says, well, no, they didn't move the street. Well, that's, the judge wouldn't have believed that if they had said it, which I don't think they did, because for years they had been tandem parkings, so they'd had a car parked on the property of the right-of-way and another car parked on the property of the Yacht Club, and another car parked behind it on the right-of-way. No one ever asserted that all those cars were parked completely in the streets. But that distance is such that had the road existed there previously, they would have all been parking in the middle of the street. So the town moves the street over right next to where the Yacht Club is, leaves a 20 or 30 foot path of right-of-way over next to the single family home so that they have now yards, trees, bushes on the right-of-way, and claims that this is what they wanted to do all along. All they had to do was move it over. If they had moved it over, they'd have had a rec path, safety issues taken care of, they'd have had the road out of the way. Yes, people still might have had to tandem park, and they still would have had to back up into the possibility that some car would come along in that particular 5 minute, that exact second of the time they were backing up. They've got to move the snow a little bit. There's no indication that moving it 200 feet was going to break the town. And when the trial judge looked at what was going on, he said, these alternatives, no, I take it back. He didn't say these alternatives were inexpensive. Two of the town's witnesses said the alternatives to fix this cost $10,000 to $20,000. But they didn't want to spend $10,000 to $20,000 to save the Yacht Club $1 to $3 million. They wanted to block the Yacht Club from being able to use its parking. They passed an ordinance 6 months after the case is filed saying, we're going to ban all parking in the right-of-way. That's the first time there was ever an ordinance doing that. And then what did they do? They put up 10 no parking signs directly across the street from the Yacht Club. That was the only place in the entire city that they put no parking signs up, even though in theory this ordinance applied to every bit of the right-of-way in the entire city. And of course the ordinance didn't make any sense in the first place, because it said what we're doing with this is preserving the right-of-way so that you have a right to drive on the right-of-way, a right-of-way which, as you'll see when you look at the pictures that are in our brief, was yards and trees and boulders and parking spaces for other cars. They didn't care about that. They just wanted to stop the Yacht Club. That's where you start getting into the fact that this is not a reasonable exercise of the police power.
Does the record indicate, Mr. Holm, perhaps this is what a juror would always want to ask, what the motive was? Is there anything in the record about why they wanted to stop just the Yacht Club? I suppose it goes to the reasonableness.
No, there isn't. There were statements made during the course of pre-litigation meetings that were held between the Yacht Club and I attended some of those, where certain statements were made that I could infer motive, but there's no
evidence. Nothing in the record. Okay, thank you.
One last thing with respect to the retrospectivity. Retrospectivity is, of course, the foundation of grandfathered uses and grandfathered buildings and that law that applies all over the place. The government cannot change the law when one is acted in reliance on a government permit, and again, the permit issued by the government and acted on by the applicant can create a vested right. There was this change when Denver Buick was overruled, and now you could allow on-site parking. There are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of houses and buildings that were built prior to the time that anyone thought they could use on-site parking, require on-site parking. Now, the city claims every one of those cities can go back and impose those kinds of restrictions.
Council, can I ask you a question? You mentioned the Goldblatt case that talked about a consideration of various factors to determine whether or not the exercise of the police power was reasonable.
Correct.
Your opposing counsel suggested that those factors would be pertinent only if there was an impediment upon the property interest by somebody else. Did you happen to cite any authority in your briefs that those factors and that analysis applies even when the regulation affects the property of the government?
Well, those particular factors relate to the police power issue,
right?
And
right.
That's not to retrospectivity.
No, and that's the issue. Actually, I'm interested in here.
Excuse me. I don't know that we did, but there are again situations where you can create unfairness, you can create unreasonableness, you can effectively take somebody's property, even though you don't possess it, by regulations that make it impossible to get any value out of that property. And so I think, sort of like my water example, that too would be an unreasonable action in my view. And so I think that actions taken by the town that affect properties clearly can be attacked. Under the Abdu case, the question is it unfair as to the specific property? And so I believe that's the case.
Thank you, Mr. Owen.
Thank you, Everson.
We thank both counsel for their briefs and their excellent oral arguments today. They're most helpful to the court, and we very much appreciate it. That case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.